This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For 2.5 years, in the Xinjiang province of far northwest China, the government has been building a network of internment camps, fenced in and policed from guard towers.
Evidence is growing that up to 1 million Muslim Uyghurs are being held by Chinese authorities in so-called re-education camps.
6 Uyghur employees of Radio Free Asia say their relatives back in Xinjiang have disappeared in the last year.
3 of my brothers and 2 of my sisters are missing. I lost contact with my mom.
The Uyghurs have been taken away, not just to suppress any nascent separatist inclinations, but to eradicate their culture, perceived, like Buddhist Tibet, to be a threat to the country's Han Chinese majority. On top of trying to reshape an entire people's way of life, the Communist Party is attempting to shape the world's perception of what is taking place, with the sometimes careless help of Western media. Historian Ryan Thum has studied Uyghur culture for 20 years and written about the Chinese government's activities. He's a senior research fellow at the University of Nottingham and author of The Sacred Roots of Uyghur History. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What is it about them that so puts the Communist Party on edge?
The overarching reason that the Chinese authorities have most frequently given is that these are people in danger of extremist mindsets. They're in danger of picking up international terrorist ideologies that will lead them to engage in acts of violent resistance against the state. The great irony here is that the things they're calling extremism are often incredibly minor. For example, giving up smoking, not selling alcohol at your convenience store, not greeting officials on the street, not watching government television, possessing any number of books, including really innocuous novels. It's actually quite difficult to avoid doing something that the government would call extremist.
Now, pretty alarmingly, you say that the Chinese propaganda push to spin the story of the Uyghur camps has been successful. Why do you think it's working?
The way in which it's working most effectively is that it has injected images created by the Chinese state of camps that have been altered and dressed up specifically for foreign audiences, filled with people who are chosen for these films and who are trained to give certain kinds of answers.
After discussing this with my family, I applied to come here voluntarily.
Most of the students are not proficient in Chinese. They are easily instigated and coerced by terrorist and extremist ideologies.
If I had not come here to study, maybe I would have followed those religious extremists and walked down the path of crime.
They have managed to inject those images into our media environment. They appear in quite a number of video segments, including one by CNN International.
Reporters witness people singing, learning Mandarin in the presence of government officials.
And stills from these videos are often placed in newspaper articles and online news sources. That's particularly powerful because we don't have any images of people in the camps that have been taken by independent media, because the Chinese state is extraordinarily careful not to allow journalists into, or even if they can help it, near these camps. So if you want an image, you're basically stuck with what the Chinese government gives you. And the ones that they've most recently passed out are incredibly deceptive.
it's particularly chilling that these same propaganda techniques were used by the Nazis in the 30s and 40s.
If you look at the very famous film, Theresienstadt, the model camp slash ghetto that the Nazis presented to the world and gave people tours of, there are some very similar images of people engaged in exercise or dance, calisthenics, images of people listening to lectures, images of people working at sewing machines, which look like the labor section of the Chinese propaganda footage. So there's a resonance in the fact that when the Nazis offered this sort of fake camp to the world, a lot of newspapers ran with it and published those images and sort of took the bait. And to a certain extent, we're seeing that again today.
It becomes a difficult decision for photo editors because even the state-supplied Potemkin Village versions of internment camp reality are pretty horrifying and call attention to the stories that are beneath, which are more horrifying still, but they kind of elide over the truth at the same time. So, you know, what is a news organization to do?
Well, there are some other options. I mean, you know, there are many dozens of these camps that have been identified on Google Earth. This imagery has been quite powerful, I think. It doesn't include humans, which is something that media outlets like to have in an image. But I think what they tell you is exactly the truth about our state of knowledge of this, which is we don't know what's happening inside of them. One of the other sets of images we have comes from local Xinjiang government that was publishing images for internal audiences before there was an international awareness of what was going on. And those images tend to emphasize, instead of these people are actually having a good time, they're emphasizing, we have the Uyghurs under control. Look at the regimented rows. Look at the enormous number of police in what appears to be SWAT clothing guarding them as they sit and listen to lectures. Look at the tall fences that they're in. And so we have these images. Now, one of the problems with those images is that they are low resolution. And some outlets have run with these. There was the cover of the New York Review of Books, for example, used one of these images.
It's not just the propaganda photos. You are seeing the press make other mistakes that obscure the reality. What are they?
One that's rare but has appeared in a couple of places is the use of the Chinese government's own language. I'm thinking in particular of a story about a tour of these dressed-up camps that was given to journalists, in which the author of the piece sometimes called them internment camps and then sometimes slipped into the Chinese government's terminology, which is right now that they're vocational training centers. They used to call them transformation education centers, and before that they called them de-extremification centers. But we see sometimes journalists picking up that terminology. A Wall Street Journal story even called them residents at one point.
Residents. That's just one short step away from guests.
Yeah, right. Another thing that's happening is that a lot of times a news outlet will, I think what they want to do is provide an image that shows that Uyghurs are Muslims. And so what they end up doing is choosing an image that has, for example, a Uyghur person praying in public or a woman with a veil. Those common stereotypes of what it means to be a Muslim are precisely the kinds of activities that the Chinese state has been cracking down on. So if you see a picture of a Muslim praying in public in Xinjiang in a newspaper story about this, it's probably going to be a stock photo from 3 or 4 years ago when in some places it was still possible to pray in public. But it's highly unlikely that anyone would do that these days. And this is, again, a problem of access. You know, when the police are erasing photos off of cameras every time the journalists go out there, it's very hard to get images. And so they have to rely on these older photos.
But that's not the only mechanism for reporting on what's going on in these camps. The Atlantic reported on people like you, scholars, and citizen journalists who are gathering evidence that even the official press simply has no access to. Can you tell me more?
aside from the excellent journalists at Radio Free Asia's Uyghur service, there are pretty much no Uyghur-speaking journalists outside of China. So some scholars who do speak Uyghur and do have a long experience in the region have made visits recently to write about what's going on there. And then we also have examples of people finding very clever ways to dig up evidence from the Chinese state itself. Probably the most important study that was done was by a scholar named Adrian Zenz from Germany, who looked at the Chinese government's advertisements asking for construction companies to submit bids to build these things. That was what really brought this issue to wide-scale attention.
So we know that the government is looking for construction of a 500,000-square-foot facility with wire fences and guard towers.
Yes. And enterprising journalists have also jumped on to this tactic. AFP produced an amazing story from over 1,000 Chinese government documents, which documented purchasing orders for cattle prods, for batons, handcuffs, something called wolf's teeth, which is apparently a spiked club. So these have been really important to showing what the real nature of these camps is.
In spite of your work, and in spite of some of the great journalism, the world does not seem to be up in arms about the plight of the Uyghurs. Where is the outrage?
The number one reason for the shortage of outrage is the economic entanglement that almost every country on the planet has with China. It's exacerbated by the fact that, at least until recently, very few people had ever heard of the Uyghurs. It's quite difficult to get people to care about a group of humans they didn't even know exist. And I think another thing that for a while made this difficult to communicate to people is that the Chinese state has been ratcheting up controls on Uyghur movement, Uyghur expression, Uyghur religious practice for 30 years now. It's been a steady increase of controls. And since 2009, if you visited the place, it looked like it's under a military occupation with caravans of military vehicles parading around the towns, checkpoints everywhere. So I think initially a lot of news outlets were skeptical that something was really dramatically different.
You've been studying the Uyghurs for at least 20 years, and I must assume that many of the people you know have been caught up in this network of internment. What has become of your friends?
I don't have very good, solid news for most of them. There's one who's definitely confirmed to be gone. The others, I haven't heard from. Quite a lot of my friends' online presence disappeared. You never know when somebody's social media account goes dark, whether it's because they've been taken away or because they're protecting themselves. Because if you have contacts with foreigners, that's one of the reasons that people get sent away.
There was in one of your pieces a reference to someone actually leaving custody, and the guard said something quite menacing.
They threatened that if you speak up, your parents are here, and so are we.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention to this issue.
Ryan Thumb is a senior research fellow at the University of Nottingham and author of The Sacred Roots of Uyghur History. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Lowinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Oster Chattavetti. We had more help from Zandra Ellen and Alice Maiden, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Jim Schachter is WNYC's Vice President for News. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.